This meeting is now being recorded.
This is the American Immigration Lawyers Association, Rome District Chapter, Practicing Law Abroad Committee. My name is Clayton Cartwright. I'm the chair of the Practicing Law Abroad Committee. Today we have a very special podcast. It's entitled Investment Planning for Outbound Practitioners and Inbound Managers and Investors. My special panelist today is Greg Fisher of Gearstein Fisher & Associates. Greg, welcome to the program. Can you give me a brief background of what you and your firm do?
Sure. Thank you, Clay, and thanks for having us today. So I'm Greg Fisher. I'm the founder and chief investment officer of Gearstein Fisher. We're an independent investment advisory and asset management firm located in New York City. We manage or consult on approximately $2 billion of assets, mostly for individuals, some families and institutions, endowments, but predominantly we work to help investors manage assets for themselves. And more information about our firm could be found at gersteinfisher.com on the web. And certainly if anyone on the call would be interested in speaking more directly with us, our phone number is 212-968-0707. And thank you.
Thanks, Greg. I mean, in the news today, it seems like every day, I mean, even on the international news website, such as the BBC website, we see news about another record high on Wall Street. Can you give us a sort of a brief background of what's your view of how things are going in the markets and what's behind it?
Sure. Well, needless to say, investors are curious about, this recovery that we've had really globally, but mostly in the U.S. The markets, if you measure the Dow, it's approximately 9,000 points higher today than it was at the bottom of the global financial crisis in March of 2009. That's approximately a 170% return. Year to date, the markets are up somewhere between 18 and 20%, and for the last 12 months, over 30%. The economic facts, on the other hand, are improving, but still not quite as strong, and it's not uncommon for the markets to be a leading indicator on economies. Markets are pricing the future, the market by default is looking at the future and trying to figure out where it's going, as compared to the economy, which is more of a lagging indicator of what's happened. So we see unemployment, housing prices, inflation, all the major economic things, they are improving a little bit, but nowhere near the growth we've seen in the stock markets in the last couple of years. So investors are, of course, asking, now that we've seen this major run-up, is it too late to invest? What should we do? Should we sell or should we bother getting in? And will there be a correction sometime soon is, of course, the million-dollar question. And of course there'll be a correction soon. I use an analogy, economists or people predicting there'll be a correction in the next couple of months or years is like a weather person predicting it's going to rain in the next 30 days. I mean, corrections are a natural part of investing. We did some research at Gearstein Fisher. We went back to the early 1900s, and what we found was that in the U.S. market, we see 15% corrections happening almost every 12 months. Now, that's not calendar year, but intra-year. So if you look at rolling 12-month periods, it's very normal to see a 15% decline almost every 12 months when you're an investor. And 30% corrections happen on average every 3 years. So investors have to some degree, be conditioned for corrections, especially after a major increase in the markets like the one we've seen. Now, another follow-up question that I think people are asking is the market overvalued? It seems to have come so far so fast. And, it is an important question to be asking when you're investing. But when we look at the market today, if you think back, if your reference point for investing was March of 2009, the bottom of the market, well, in fact, it's been a pretty impressive run. But if your reference point was, let's say, the beginning of January 2000, what you find is the market has barely grown at all. The market has hit this peak that we're at today roughly three times. March of 2000, we saw it again in 2007, and we're seeing it again now. So if you don't count dividends, there's been virtually no price return in the stock market for 13 years, and there's something of about an 8% cumulative return over 13 years when you include dividends. At the same period of time, bonds, the risk-free alternatives in the U.S., have done significantly better. Now, we learned back in economics that risk and return are supposed to be related. And if you go back 13 years, what we find is that the risk-free asset, the government bond, or what was once thought of as risk-free anyway, earned a return of significantly greater than the stock market. So I think reference points are an important thing to be aware of when people are asking these questions. Another thing about the value of the market today is if we look at things like the price-to-earnings ratio, it doesn't look significantly higher than it's been over the last 20 years, and it's just slightly north of the historical average as we sit here today. When we look at things like the dividend yield on the stock market and compare it to the 10-year treasury, the 10-year treasury today is something of about 1.9% in terms of its yield, and that's approximately the same yield on the stock market. So if you have a choice of buying a 10-year bond earning just south of 2%, where there's really no growth potential, and many people would think some potential for loss of value if interest rates should change, and you compare that to the dividend yield on the stock market, I think stocks look fairly attractive from that point of view. Similarly, if we look at the earnings yield now is about 6% on the stock market. And if you compare that to the roughly 2% yield on a 10-year treasury, it's about three times. So in many ways, when we compare the dividend yield, the earnings yield, the price-to-earnings ratio, and a variety of other metrics, and compare them to where we've been in the past, the market doesn't look overly valued. Housing prices are a big issue, and they're still 30% off the peak in the United States. So we've had this massive recovery in the stock market, but one of the key assets that people in the U.S. and I think globally have is the homes they live in, and these assets have really not grown much at all. They're still 30% off where they were at the peak before the financial crisis. So these are just some points about the current market conditions that I think we all need to be aware of. And these are times for investors to think very carefully about their strategy and risk tolerance.
Greg, that's a great point about the time with the global market. A lot of our many of our members, I'd say a half or more of the members of the Rome District Chapter are based overseas. And so can you address, I guess, maybe tie in some international aspects here? I mean, particularly the fact that our members are, most of those international members are based in Europe. And, of course, you know, we hear all, the other day I read an article that Europe was the sick man of Europe, not just one country. So if you could address those concerns and to the extent that, you know, where the U.S. is vis-a-vis, say, the European markets.
Absolutely. Well, I think, I think back to about a year and a half ago when the European crisis was really at its core. And what we were telling all of our investors globally is that, you know, in the long run, you might want to take the position that markets do a good job pricing risk. And clearly, you know, from the perspective of folks both in Europe and outside, I think we look at Europe and some of the challenges that have happened very much like the way we were looking at the U.S. in the financial crisis, and we were pricing the risk. There was a point in time a year ago where the European markets were trading at such a discount relative to the U.S. market, where in the long run there was no good logic as to why, you know, a large business in Europe versus a large business in the U.S. in the same industry, in the same sector, selling products to almost the same universe of folks. In the long run, the cost of capital of those two businesses should be the same or similar. And said another way, the expected return for investors should be the same or similar. As a matter of fact, when you look at the returns of big cap stocks in the developed world, ex-U.S., the U.S. and Japan over 40 years, it's ironic, but the returns are almost identical. The path of how we all got there is, of course, very different. So I think a point would be that when you're investing globally, you want to look for opportunities where certain markets are viewed as risky, assume that markets are doing a good job pricing the risk, and I think investors should be exposed to those parts of the world if, in fact, the relationship of risk and return being related continues to hold up. Now, when you look at the world in general, I mean, the United States, 20 years ago when I started my firm, Gerstein Fischer, the U.S. represented about 65% of the world capital market. And here we are today, and the U.S. represents about 45% of the world capital market. You know, we've given up about 1 percentage point per year of market share. So I think it's a mistake for any investor to be, you know, narrowly focused in any one region. And I think being globally diversified is critical. Right now, the ex-US developed world is about 40% of the world market, and the emerging economies are around 12%. Those numbers are extraordinarily different from where they were 20 years ago. We've seen, you know, assets outside of the US continue to grow as a percentage of worldwide market cap.
Greg, thanks for that. We're going to pause for a few minutes here for a technical break, and we will be back. This is the podcast series of the Rome District Chapter.
This meeting is now being recorded.
And we're back. This is the podcast series of the Rome District Chapter. Our special guest panelist today is Greg Fisher. Greg, as we've mentioned previously, a big bulk of our members are U.S. lawyers practicing abroad, and some of whom may be, say, for example, in the U.K. permanently. Some may have an eye to return to the U.S. If you take someone, say, my age, which I'll say I'm in my wink-wink early 40s, at 44, somebody roughly my age that may either be looking to stay in the UK but still wants to have some U.S. market exposure. Maybe they worked at a firm before and they had some qualified retirement plan assets that are in place. And but in some circumstances they may be looking to stay, for example, in France or in the UK for until they pass away, or they may look to return to the U.S. when they retire, say, and their retirement age keeps creeping upward, say, when they're 70. Can you address that situation and provide some insight to our members?
Absolutely. You know, I think what I'd like to do is discuss an overall framework for how to think about this, a process for thinking about how to make these decisions, because at the core, what we're talking about is where will I be living and what currency am I going to have my liabilities in? The big issue here, I think, is, you know, if I'm living in one country for 3 to 5 years and then returning to another, or if I'm moving to another country and going to stay there for 10 or 15 years or for the long term, all of these issues become relevant from an investment point of view for a number of reasons. But at the highest level, it's really a currency risk. And what currency am I going to be spending my money in? Because one of the risks that all investors have is that they have liabilities at some point. For people retiring, it's the income they need to live on. For someone at a, you know, sort of earlier in their life, it might be money they're saving to buy a home at some point in time, or educating their kids, or something they're going to need from their investments. And one of the risks we have, other than just overall market risk, which is one risk in itself, is the currency risk. So what I think is important here is for investors to try their best to figure out where will they be spending money in the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. And if they can figure that out, those funds should be invested in the currency that they're going to be spending. So for example, if I know that I'm living in the United States and I expect to be here for the next 5 to 7 years, what I would want to do is to have a fair amount of liquidity and also investments in the dollar so that I don't take on the currency risk of having another currency fluctuating while my liabilities are in dollars. And of course, you could take that perspective in any country that you're sitting in. On the other hand, once we start getting out beyond this 5 to 7 year time horizon, well, then there may be certain risks that investors could afford to take. But I think there are two risks we're focusing on here, one being currency risk and the other being general market risk. Now, if you were to start with a neutral position to currency and a neutral position to exposure to the equities of countries, and you could do this for the bond market as well. You know, for example, right now, when we look at the world is currently, I'm rounding, approximately 48% United States, approximately 40% developed countries ex-United States, and approximately 12% emerging markets. So if you were neutral to currency and you wanted your exposure to investments to be neutral to country, you would basically look at the world once a month, see where those market capitalization weightings are, and you could just build a portfolio exposed in exactly the percentages that the world weightings were. Now, most investors don't stop there, though. What happens is, if you're living in Europe, and your exposure and your liabilities were in the euro, well, in that case, you may not want to be neutral to the euro. You may want to overweight the euro to the world benchmark because of your liabilities being based in the euro. And again, similarly, if you were in Japan or if you were in China or if you were in the United States. So most investors do have a home bias for two reasons. One is because they're more comfortable owning the things in the country that they're most familiar with, or the country that they're living in, and that is more of a behavioral issue. But the other reason that's more of the rational financial reason for overweighting a particular country might have to do predominantly with the currency risk of not having your investments in the currency that you're going to be spending money in the years you need to spend the money.
Yeah, and so we have the situation here. I mean, that's a good transition, a good segue to, you know, our clientele, for example, say someone who comes in who's transferred to the U.S. on an L visa for 5 years, for example, and the idea is they, you know, this particular person is introduced into your office, and the idea is that they're on a U.S. rotation. They are not going to, there's no desire for, in this hypothetical, for the individual to get on the path to a green card, to have lawful permanent resident status. They're just in the U.S. for 5 years, and they'll be rotated out, say, to Poland. Will be the next stop on their tour, their world tour. In that particular situation, how do you balance, shifting currency risk? I mean, sometimes we know where they're going to, and maybe they're going back into the Eurozone, maybe they're going back to the U.K., but the client comes into your office and says, okay, well, you know, I'm working my way up the corporate ladder. I'm doing well, but I don't know where my next assignment is going to be in 2018. And I don't know where my currency risk is going to be. I know I'm not going to be in the U.S. because, you know, I intend on doing well, and I intend on being promoted somewhere upward and probably outward.
Sure. Well, I think it really does start with diversification. So no matter where you are or where you think you'll be or where you end up, you know, the story of diversification makes sense. You know, diversifying across currencies. Now, I wouldn't necessarily recommend investors just buy currency because there's no expected return of the actual currency. But, you know, buying businesses or bonds, in these countries where you have the currency exposure, and I think it would start with diversification. So if I were someone who really didn't know where I was going to be, had very little insight, I would consider the world neutral, fully diversified exposure, because over time I'd want exposure to each of these economies. You know, we all know that in any given year it's a little random as to which country is our best performer, so having diversification across countries and starting with this neutral position. But then you might do some form of process of elimination. Like if you knew that the likelihood of being in the U.S. for the long term was small, well, you could consider underweighting the U.S. currency in that example and maybe slightly tilting or overweighting your exposure to the country where you think you're more likely to end up. And if you don't end up in that country for whatever reason, you know, ultimately you do want to have diversification across a broad basket of all countries. So again, this framework of starting with the world neutral decision, we know that markets on average are very difficult to outperform. The reality is when you look at, you know, how did the market get to this 48% U.S., 40% developed, 12% emerging? Well, it's billions of people all over the world buying and selling securities from one another, and those market weightings are the average opinion of lots of folks. So, you know, if you just start with the market neutral position, which is the fully diversified position, it's actually a very good place to start. Then from there, I think each of us can tilt to or away from certain countries based on our probability of ending up in those countries, you know, the areas that we think we might end up residing in long term. Those would be, I think, the kinds of ways that I would handle that issue.
So it makes it a little easier, for example, say if you have someone here in the U.S. on an investor visa, say an E2, where, you know, where they're renewing it every 5 years, where they're not, they think they may settle here, but they may renew, you know, year, you know, term after term after term, or they may go back to France, or to the extent, and I see this issue frequently, where you have a U.S. Lawful permanent resident who is facing a naturalization decision because they want to go over and spend, go back to their native country, say France, for a number of years. But they're still not sure. They're, you know, because no, there's no, when you talk about a client's perceptions and you talk about where they want to end up, you know, particularly somebody who is, a client who is upwardly mobile, they're in their 30s and 40s, they don't know where they want to be in 25 years, but there's an idea that they're either going to be, say, in the U.S. or in their country of birth. And so I guess that makes that decision, right, a little easier for you in terms of balancing risk?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, those are all factors to consider. You know, as we're talking through this, I think another thing that people often consider is to eliminate currency risk through hedging strategies. Now, I generally don't think that's the wise choice, but, you know, if an investor really didn't want to be bothered with this at all, there would be a way to hedge currency risk. You know, the problem with hedging is it's insurance, and over time it's likely to drag down the return of investors in the long run. So my preference would be to take on the risk, but diversify as much of it away through exposures to multiple countries, and as we were just talking, you know, tilt the exposure to the country's currency where you think you're most likely to end up spending more time.
Great, Craig. Well, thank you very much for that, and thank you for taking the time today to give us your thoughts on the markets and how investment decisions relate to our membership and to our clients. I really appreciate the time that you've taken here. This is the conclusion of our podcast. Again, this podcast was brought to you by the Rome District Chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. I am Clayton Cartwright, the chair of the Practicing Law Broad Committee. The Practicing Law Broad Committee consists of Jonathan Davis, Janice Flynn, Claire Nielsen. Our executive committee member is Sal Sabateri. I also would like to thank Matthew Amolos for providing some special input today for today's podcast. Our special panelist today was Greg Fisher. Thank you for listening, and have a good day.